you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 241 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host, as usual. Today, my guest is three-time returning champion, Megan Xavier. Megan is an attorney out in California handling representation for attorneys who have issues with bar counsel there in California, as well as a prolific writer and speaker at various legal conferences around the country. She's been on our program twice before, as you'll hear during the episode. And today I've asked her to come back because she had a recent article that appeared in Attorney at Work about how to structure your fee agreements. And if you're an attorney like me, a solo or small firm practitioner, you know, I got to tell you, to be honest, my fee agreements are cut and paste jobs that could use a lot of work. So when I saw this article of Megan's, I knew right away that this is something I wanted to chat with her about, and we would get educated on, you know, some of the concerns and issues that arise from and as a result of improperly drafted fee agreements. So get out a pad of paper. I took an entire sheet of notes during the interview on things that I need to do to punch up and improve my fee agreements. So get out a pad of paper, do the same. I think you'll be better off for it. So without any further delay, again, here is Megan Xavier. Megan Xavier, welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to have you once again. For our listeners who may not recognize your name, this is Megan's third time on the program, making her a repeat champion. I think we probably should get, like, I don't know, T-shirt for three, a ring for four, maybe a tiara for five, right?
Nice.
Something like that. Anyway, Megan was on the program initially with our friend Aaron Gerstenzang at episode 165, talking about social media issues. And then again, just a scant 10 weeks later at episode 175, talking about bar counsel investigations, a subject that all of us need to be educated a bit on. And I've asked Megan to join us again today as a result of an article that initially appeared at Attorney at Work that she wrote having to do with fee agreements, which is the quickest way to find your way to bar counsel if you don't do those very well. So I wanted to spend some time sort of as preventive medicine. Let's fix the problem, and then we won't have to deal with the aftermath. So by way of introduction, Megan, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So I am currently a solo attorney. I represent other lawyers facing state bar discipline investigations in California. I also advise lawyers on ways to avoid trouble.
Yeah.
So I do ethics consulting, and also I have a subscription service where I advise my clients on issues that pop up in their practice. And in every subscription, I review my clients' fee agreements. That's a basic service of that, because I think it's really important, because state bar complaints often come back to what's in the fee agreement. And I got here by way of big law, where I spent way too long doing federal securities litigation before striking out on my own was something I find far more satisfying.
Yeah. So we had talked previously about your experience in big law and how you got to go out on your own and how you came to be focused on helping other attorneys stay out of trouble and deal with trouble when it comes upon them. And one of the, you know, look, if it's not the major cause of bar counsel complaints, it's pretty high up there. And regardless of what type of action brings you before your bar counsel, I venture to say a great many of them have some aspect rooted in the fee agreement with the client.
That's true. And also something that I think a lot of lawyers don't think about is that when you get a letter from the state bar investigating a client complaint, the first document they ask for is your fee agreement. So even if the client has not said a word about the fee agreement or any terms in it, that's a basic document that the state bar wants to see. And you can be brought up on charges that have nothing to do with the fee agreement. But if there's something in there that violates the rules, they may as well throw that in too, right? And so you end up with an additional charge. It's like, what? I had no idea that was going to be a thing. And so it's a really important document to spend some time on. And it's one that's pretty simple once you have spent the time to just use your template from client to client. So it's really well invested time to get your fee agreement tuned up and really focus it to make sure it has the terms it needs, doesn't have terms it shouldn't, because that's always an issue too. And then you have a solid template going forward and you can feel confident using it and know that if the bar ever does ask you for it, you have no problem showing it.
Well, I can tell you, you know, from my own experience, and I'm going to cop to the fact that all the things that we're going to be talking about here, I personally have violated in some way or another, either explicitly or implicitly to some degree or another. When I started to read the article and go down the list of issues, I went, oh my God, did that. Oh my God, I remember when that happened. Okay. So, I mean, I'm a perfect example that this really can happen to any attorney. And I think let's talk about the process just for a second, you know, before we get started here. If you're like most attorneys, if you're like me, if I'm like most attorneys, you know, the way I got started with my fee agreement was to borrow somebody else's.
Sure. Or the bars, sometimes they put out samples.
Some cases the bar provides samples. And you pick one that kind of looks like it fits and you tailor it and then you never think about it again.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact that you've now added practice areas to your practice, and so maybe this practice area should have different terms, or you've started accepting payment on a different methodology than you did in the beginning, and you've not gone back and revisited things, or you haven't updated it based on, you know, events that have occurred over the course of time, and pretty soon you have an outdated and potentially worthless fee agreement that you're using all the time.
Right. Or even, I don't know if it's worse, but another way that we see it is you may have added terms to it because of something that happened, but you didn't really smooth it out so that now you end up with conflicting terms or other things that are inconsistent in it that just make it really a mess. And then, of course, as we learned in first year contracts, you're going to find that that agreement is construed against you as the drafter and the lawyer in the relationship.
And I will give you a perfect example straight out of my own experience, okay? I had a difficult case in a county that required me to travel a lot, and I was wasting a lot of time in my mind. And I think, well, why am I not including travel in my travel costs in my fee agreement? So I put together some stuff, and I put it in the fee agreement, and it ended up being completely out of date and conflicting with other parts of the agreement. And it wasn't until a client actually said, I'm not paying that because it says here that you're absorbing all those costs. And I had to agree. You know, I done exactly what you said. It enhanced the agreement, but hadn't smoothed it out. And I had conflicting terms. And fortunately, wasn't a lot of money, so I wasn't going to go to the mat on that, but I learned the hard way.
That's a great example.
Yeah. So, all right, let's get started here. So let's assume, you know, you're going to start at least from a starting point, okay? You got something that you can start and take a look at. Some of the key components that you laid out in your article. One that might be kind of self-evident here, but that is you have to identify the client properly. And again,
yeah, it's not as self-evident as you might think.
No,
it seems simple.
Again, I found out the hard way because, you know, sometimes, like I do estate planning primarily now, and sometimes, you know, it's the adult child who is contacting you on behalf of the elderly parent. Well, who is your client? It's really the elderly parent, and while that sounds obvious in the case, you got to make sure that the agreement is clear on that. So talk a little bit about the challenges about identifying the client properly.
This is an issue that was raised to me or highlighted to me years ago. I was asked to give a presentation with two other lawyers on, well, the presentation was titled, "What do you mean I'm not your client?"
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, okay, we're going to give an hour CLE on identifying your client. And if you know, first I'm like, an hour? We're going to talk for an hour about who's your client? Like, are you kidding me? What a simple question and how ridiculous that we're going to, you know, bore people to death for an hour. And then as we dove into it, it was easy to fill an hour with all kinds of scenarios and hypotheticals and things that come from the three panelists' real life practice. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, this is really not such a simple question. So your example is a good one. You know, a third party actually is your primary contact for an individual client. So that can be an elderly parent. It can be a language barrier situation, a physical proximity situation, very obvious in criminal matters where someone's incarcerated and the client is clearly the person in jail. And the person talking to you is the free person who's able to come to your office. So there's a lot of times where it's just someone running as a go-between between you and the actual client. But it can be more complicated. You know, partners, two partners come in with an issue related to their partnership. Are you representing one partner, both partners, the partnership, all of those things, all of the above?
Yeah.
With a corporate entity, it becomes kind of more clear how there's an issue. I think just to our issue spotting lawyer brains, like, oh yeah, we can more easily see that. I represented the controller of a huge public company when I was a securities litigator. And so our firm was his counsel, but then every other individual involved, you know, CEO, CFO, all of them had their own individual counsel. And then another law firm represented the entity. And you suddenly have, you know, alphabet soup with a bajillion different law firms involved. But those are all separate clients. And we tend to think, especially as solo and small firms, like, oh, that won't happen to me. It's a lot simpler. I just represent individuals. You know, take my practice, for example. I represent the lawyer against whom a bar complaint's been filed. That seems really simple. Well, most of the time it is. And it's easy to get complacent because it usually is. But what if the person contacting me is actually saying, well, the complaint was filed against this person, this partner, but they never touched the case. The real exposure is this person who's not yet named, but we know will be, you know, and now, oh, right. Okay, hang on a second. So it can get complicated. And what's important, you know, there's really two pieces. One is that you are clear yourself in your own head who your client is, because that's the individual to whom, or the entity to whom you owe obligations of confidentiality. That's where privilege lies. That's where your duties, you know, to represent them diligently and competently. It's all to the client. But also that the human beings you are talking to all know who you represent. And I say it that way because if you're dealing with an entity, the entity can't talk. Right? The entity is not a body. So there's a human that you're talking to, but that human may not be the client. And they need to know that and be completely clear so that there's no confusion about your obligations and theirs.
a couple of factors that muddy the waters there and make it difficult. One is oftentimes in the client's mind, the person who's paying feels they're the client. And the person who's paying may not always be the client.
That's true.
And the second one I see frequently is when you represent a married couple. And particularly in an estate planning practice. So who is owed a duty of confidentiality and who can waive that duty? It's something that I think you have to sort out right from the very beginning. You can't wait till something pops up. It has to be clear, as you said, to the humans involved.
Exactly. And you raise a good point, like the person paying the bill thinks it's them. Well, if you represent small businesses, especially family businesses, you may find that they're not all set up, all beautiful on the corporate side, right, with entities and the legal formalities all in place and legal fictions of walls and entities all abided by. Brother and sister go into business together and they're like, yeah, what are we, partners? Yeah, I guess we're kind of partners. And they start working together and maybe that money got deposited in a personal account and a bill was paid. And that happens. Small business is not
all
always
all the
run.
Time. Happens all the time.
Right? Yeah. And now, brother wrote the check and it came out of his personal account. So he thinks he's the client. But in truth, that money really belonged to the partnership. You can see how it could get complex.
So one thing that seems to be obvious is identifying who the client is. The other thing that seems to be obvious is identifying what work is to be done. And, I know in a lot of cases there is an effort by attorneys to broadly define the scope of work so that they don't have to modify the agreement later on, which shouts to me as a bad practice potential for issues there, or in other cases to use kind of an overly formulaic definition of the work. I see it all the time with agreements that say have a bunch of check marks next to areas of where the law might be applied, and so what really is being covered in this agreement isn't all that clear under the scope of work.
Yeah, scope of work is a place you can really get in trouble because that default to a broad definition is really dangerous to the lawyer. If you are billing in a flat fee basis, I think flat fee lawyers tend to get a little more concerned about what's in the scope of work because it's very obvious to them that they risk getting burned with the work ballooning up to more than they're honestly getting paid for. So they tend to be a little more careful in defining the scope. But even on an hourly basis, you don't want to be too broad because now if it just says, pursue claims related to, employment termination, what does that mean? State claims, a state board of some kind, federal claims, all litigation, all, tangential civil suits you might be able to bring. What does that mean? And so you have now committed yourself to an unending amount of work, but maybe the client didn't intend that you were going to do that unending amount of work. So now you go, I guess I have carte blanche to go investigate 1,000 different ways I could litigate this thing. And now the client goes, well, I'm not paying you for that because that's not what I was trying to hire you for. And there's just a big conflict now over what is it you're supposed to do? And the flip side of that is that if you have defined it too broadly, you might be found to be on the hook for more work than you intended. Maybe you said pursue claims, but in your head, that just meant file a state court lawsuit. And now a federal statute of limitations runs and you're blamed for not having pursued that claim. You say, well, no, I never intended that. And you look back at the fee agreement and someone could say, well, that really could have included this. And again, it's going to be construed against you. So that scope of work really should be very clearly delineated. This is what I'm agreeing to do. If you're going to ask me to do more, we'll enter into a separate agreement. I mean, it's not that big of a headache to modify a fee agreement and have a rider that says, now all the terms we already agreed to apply to this additional work, sign and date. That's really not that hard. Yeah.
Two areas where I see this manifest itself is, There's an effort by attorneys frequently to limit the scope of their work. And I'm going to give an example in family law. I've seen this. I agree to represent you as long as this remains a largely uncontested matter.
Well, that's vague.
Yeah. Yeah. Should it become more complex and litigation be involved, then we agree to enter into a new agreement. And you know, you may understand what you mean by that scope of work, but the client doesn't know where the line of demarcation is.
Mm-mm. Not at all.
That's one. And then the other part is not knowing what signifies the end of the matter.
Yeah, that's a big one, because you want to know when you're done.
And I would think, like, again, in my case, estate planning, the end of the matter is when I hand you your estate plan, right? Well, I've had clients that say, well, I thought you were also going to kind of represent me if it gets contested. You're my attorney, right? The will to... Mm-hmm. No, not in that respect. So, you know, we also include a termination letter. That's what helps address what the scope of the work is. So,
or like estate planning, you might say, well, we had another child. I wanted you to modify it. Didn't I already pay you for that when you did my estate plan?
Well, that walks us right into, you know, probably an area that has, one of the most contentious aspects of it is getting paid, how you're getting paid, what the fee is, and what the payment terms are. It's clearly an area where we could spend a lot of time.
We could have a whole show just on that. But yeah, those are obviously key pieces. They're sometimes the only piece the client bothers to read when they sign off on it. And certainly where you want to make sure that the terms are clear, because again, this is all going to be construed against you. If you end up in a fee dispute, you're not going to get everything you thought you had gotten them to agree to. It has to be really, really clear.
Yeah, it has to be clear. And you have to also anticipate, I would think, problems, and put language in your agreements to mitigate those areas. I know when I first started doing family law, I just assumed people would pay their bills on time.
Oh, how naive.
Yeah, and how naive, right? I got an agreement. This is how the Evergreen retainer system works. I'm going to send you the bill at the end of the month for the work that I've done. I'm going to pay myself out of your retainer. This is all clear. And you're going to replenish that retainer. Well, it's that last part that often gets overlooked.
Uh-huh.
Replenishing that retainer. Now I'm into the next month, and I got more work to do. I'm depleting that retainer further. And pretty soon, we're out of money to pay me as the attorney, but I still have work I'm on the hook to do. And I haven't put any language in the agreement as to what's going to happen under those circumstances. You know, am I going to charge a late fee? Is there interest involved with the balance due? And what happens if you don't pay me?
Yeah, those are super important terms, because when you enter into the fee agreement, you're just kind of all aglow, you know, oh, new client, things are good. Right. But the real importance of the fee agreement is when things aren't so good. And so you need to prepare for that. And non-payment is huge, especially in hourly billing. And this is very common. This is just how things work, that you end up with outstanding bills and waiting to hear, are you going to pay that? Are you going to contest it? Are you going to tell me you need a payment plan? Are you going to fire me, or am I going to withdraw? Like, you just are in limbo as this bill is sitting out there. But you're right, the work doesn't stop. And you cannot just drop the client. You can't just be like, oh, I'm not filing that response that's due tomorrow till you pay your bill. Like, yeah, you got to file that response. And they probably know that, you know, if they have any sense of lawyer obligations. And you certainly already know that. So you have to figure out what that's going to look like for you, what it needs to look like to stay in business, and how are you going to handle these situations, and put those terms in the original fee agreement so you know exactly what to do, because you've already agreed to it with the client.
And it gives you an opportunity to set the expectations as well.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, because I think there are again, when it comes to solo practitioners, most of solo and small firm practitioners, less so, I think, with big firms, although I may be wrong here, I think there is the potential for a client to say, well, they're doing okay. They got a nice office. They're an attorney. You know, if I don't pay my bill on time, you know, they're not going to lose their office. They're not going to lose their house. But in point of fact, all of that could very well be true.
Oh, yeah. Especially in the solo small firm world.
Yeah. And so expecting them to float you alone, you know, not having that clear expectation that that's not how we're going to manage this relationship. I think it's important to get in concrete terms in the agreement. And, you know, even something little insidious, like you know, starting to do some work on a flat fee basis, and then you have a fee to pay to the court or a fee to pay to the IRS to get a EIN number or something. If your agreement doesn't, is silent on the issue of who pays the fees above the legal services being tendered, I think you're on the hook in many cases, or at least it's an area that's going to be contentious.
It could be contentious because depending on your state's rules, you might not be allowed to advance those fees, or at least, or even just to pay them. Usually we can at least advance them, but you have to look at your rules and see what you're even able to do. You could put yourself in a real pickle. And so all of those things, anything dealing with money, yeah, should be dealt with in the fee agreement. Probably your, you know, most important terms, in as least as far as staying in business as a lawyer.
Today's episode is brought to you by the team at Spotlight Branding. For many years, lawyers like you have spent thousands of dollars on marketing campaigns that generate tons of leads, but often left many of them in the dust once the campaign ended. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. Their content loop system not only nurtures all of your leads and contacts in perpetuity, but it's done by pushing out quality evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing efforts actually work. Spotlight Branding's content loop makes it nearly impossible for your network to forget about you, which means they'll think of you first when they or someone they know needs legal help. Spotlight Branding has turned hundreds of lawyers across the country into the go-to attorney in their community with their content loop by producing engaging content that speaks to your clients' needs and fears, and they can do the same for you. To get started, they're offering listeners of The Law Entrepreneur a free download that explains the content loop and how you can put it into practice in your law firm's marketing strategy. Just go to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, spotlightbranding.com/TLE to get your copy. Spotlight Branding, more referrals, better clients, higher ROI. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And this episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. Well, let's move on to an area that I had a wise attorney counsel me early in my solo practice, who said, if you pay attention to nothing else in your agreement, figure out the clause for terminating the agreement and make that as strong as you can, as clear as you can. Under what conditions can you, if you find that client that you can't work with or who isn't paying their bills or for whatever-ish reason, you need to terminate the agreement. What are some of the challenges that the attorneys face in including that in their fee agreements?
Well, there's several aspects to it that you need to address that I think people don't necessarily realize. The first seems really obvious. How do I get out of this? You know, what happens if you don't pay me? As can like be that being, you know, of paramount importance, right? What happens if you don't pay me? Or what happens if I'm just tired of you and I'm so sick of your 2 a.m. texts and repeated phone calls and I'm done? Mm-hmm. Right? How do I get out?
Obviously, by the way, how do you know most of my old former clients? Go ahead.
We've all had those.
No, I've had lovely past former clients and just one or two that fall into that category.
Yeah. So how do you get out, right? That's a really obvious thing about termination. But okay, let's say you've gotten past that. You've described in there, this is when I can get out and this is what I will do and this is how it will all happen. Okay, great. Now, what happens to the money? They still owe you, or you have money for them, or you charged a flat fee and you actually got out before the scope of work was done. How does that get handled? You probably feel, if you're frustrated and angry at a client, that you've earned anything that you've been paid. Well, that might not be seen the same way unless you describe in your agreement what those terms are. And by the way, you can often have an agreement where there's a flat fee paid, but you put in the termination clause, if this agreement is terminated before we are done with the scope of work, then we bill hourly against your flat fee, which will often have you earning the whole flat fee. And it was really that they were getting a bonus by paying a flat fee for the work. But people will do that, and it's usually upheld as a way to end up compensated for the time and effort that you've put into a case.
Just
but you
a
have
quick
to figure
practice.
That out.
Just a quick practice tip there. If your agreement does say that, make sure you're keeping track of your time on an hourly basis, even if you're charging on a flat fee. Because you can't then turn around and say, all right, I'm terminating this. I think I'm about halfway through. Let me figure out or gin up a bill that represents half the hourly work.
Right. No, you have to have some contemporaneous time records.
Because you're just throwing gas on the fire at that point.
Right, because the client's already going to be upset. You didn't finish everything you're terminating. They think they should get it back. Right.
So but also, do hourly record keeping, even if you're not doing hourly billing.
Exactly. And that comes in handy in various scenarios of client disputes, but that's a big one. If you withdraw and that's the term in your agreement. Then also, what about things like their file and what you'll agree to do with transitioning it? You know, do they already have access because it's an electronic file? You use a client portal. You could put in there, you always have access to your file upon termination. It's your responsibility to download it, or we'll send it to you via email, or we will paper copy it and have it available for you to pick up. Like, what are you going to do? Because transitioning the file back to them is a key component of any termination, and certainly a withdrawal midway through the representation, because the assumption is they need to go to another lawyer, so they need their file to do that.
Yep. And alert them if there's statute of limitations coming up or other important dates.
Right, which would go in a termination letter that you would send to them and probably repeat it in a cover letter returning their file. Not really something you'd put in the fee agreement itself, but definitely something to keep in mind if you ever are terminating midway.
What about, how do you handle disputes? What about adding clauses in there for dispute resolution? It's an area where I have to admit I haven't fleshed my agreement out a lot.
So some people won't even have a dispute resolution clause, and then you just look at you know, your state and how they have it set up when there is a dispute. Do you have mandatory fee arbitration? Do you have the ability to just go sue right away? You know, usually our attorney regulation provides some input into how disputes are resolved with clients. But the other thing that I like to see is an explicit agreement as to what are we going to do. Because even if you have mandatory fee arbitration, you can also agree to an arbitration clause if your state allows it. Not all of them do, but some do. So you could have a straight up arbitration clause. So if mandatory fee arbitration is either waived by the client or fails, that we go to arbitration before we can sue. Location, you know, form selection clause can be in there. That's always useful, especially if you are not local to the client or you serve clients all over the place and you don't want to be subjected to dispute resolution in multiple places. I mean, hopefully you don't have multiple client right. disputes going on. But, you know, if you represent people throughout the state where you're licensed, I mean, I'm in California, that's a huge state. If I'm way up north, then they're down in San Diego. It could be many, many hours away. I don't want to have to go down there if I don't have to. So forum selection clauses are important too.
Yeah, you know, as he makes furious notes to himself, that's an area that I need to do a little more research and figure out what I need to do, because my agreements are pretty shallow in that regard. So I'm learning something myself here. What about...
You know, one clause I like to see, by the way, I'll just... One more thing about dispute resolution is when attorneys put in that we will attempt, you know, in good faith to mediate or negotiate before we resolve, we resort to formalities. I don't know how often clients and attorneys actually do it, but it kind of gives everyone pause. Like, hey, we did agree we would try and work it out. It doesn't benefit anybody to end up in a forum when you have a dispute. So I like to see those clauses. I hope they're enforced.
Again, another note to self. you know, one of the things I think is often overlooked, and again, I was lucky enough that the firm that I worked with originally willingly let me borrow their fee agreement when I first started out. And it had a pretty significant section in there about what the client's obligations were. And, you know, what the firm was expecting in terms of communications and payment, of course, and decorum, which you wouldn't think you need to put in an agreement, but sadly is more and more prevalent in our society these days. So what is it that you'd like to see in terms of the client obligations reflected in a fee agreement?
Well, at the very least, you should have in there that the client will keep you informed as to where they are and how to reach them, and that they will respond when you contact them. Now, this isn't necessarily something where, you know, oh, I'm going to enforce that contractual provision. Well, by the time you get to any point of enforcement, you know, you're way past the problem you had when you couldn't reach the client. But if you sit with your client and go through the fee agreement, or you at least try and ensure that they've read it, this seems to help just to like drive home to them, like, look, I can't do this without you. I can't go represent your interests without knowing the facts, without being able to ask you when something comes up. But I have to do things like respond to the court when they tell me to. So if I can't reach you, I'm going to end up responding to the court with the best knowledge I have, and it might hurt you. Like, you know, you kind of drive home to them, like, you need to be in touch with me. So where they are and how to reach them and if they'll communicate back to you are at least the basics of what I like to see in a fee agreement. Depending on your practice area, you may have some other things. Decorum is a really good one. A friend of mine was describing a court hearing by Zoom where the opposing party, thankfully it was not her client, was in bed smoking a joint while appearing in court. You know, you don't think you have to say this. You will appear fully clothed in proper attire at all court appearances, whether by Zoom or in person. Right. You know, things like that should be in there if that's something that may come up in your practice area. I will tell you, it never occurred to me as representing lawyers that I would have to tell them how to appear on Zoom. Turns out I do.
It turns out you do. I'm going to resist the urge to reference a news item. about a lawyer appearing on a Zoom conference call yesterday. I threw my own self off there. I have to make a note of the time here. Let's talk about, in summary, what about when the, you know, aspects of, if the law changes underneath, you know, the ground changes underneath you, the law has changed, and what effect changing the law might have on the representation? Is that something, you have it in your article, and I guess I'm not really sure what that means.
Well, it won't apply to everyone. I mean, I'm not particularly worried that the state bar will stop prosecuting lawyers. So I don't have something in my fee agreement about this.
Right.
But, you know, certain old stories like really resonate and stick with you. When I was at my first big law firm, there was a partner who thankfully I did not work for, but he was known for just being a terror. And the lawyers who did work for him, banking regulation lawyers, the associates were just all so miserable. And it's like his name just struck fear in you. You know, this guy was just awful. And I came in the office one morning and I was told he didn't work there anymore. And it was like, what? Seriously? Like how? This guy was incredibly powerful, had all of these associates running around in circles, right? And it turned out that Congress had passed a regulation or a law that it wiped out his practice area. Whatever it was that was his specialty within banking regulation, it didn't exist anymore. And all of those associates threw a party, right? But here, like literally one day, his practice area no longer existed.
So what happened to the clients?
Well, they didn't need the work that he had been contracted to do. Now, today, in solo small firm practice especially, I'm not particularly worried that the federal government is going to snap its fingers and wipe out most practice areas. But you know who's really at risk of this is immigration lawyers. They could have a practice where, you know, I'm pursuing a specific type of visa for a certain type of person. And this is my little niche. And then that visa is not available anymore. Like they changed it or they changed the rules. And now the particular type of client I serve isn't eligible anymore because of something new that changed. And because there's more nuances with that, I mean, the banking example is extreme, right? But you could be midway through an engagement pursuing a form of relief, which suddenly isn't available anymore.
Well, the area of the law that changes frequently, in my estimation, that impacts the quality of your representation is tax law.
Oh, sure. That's similar to immigration, right? Federal law can just, they can change things dramatically.
Yeah. And something is as simple, not as simple, but something as critical as, you know, a major tax exemption, say the federal estate tax exemption. If that changes dramatically, it changes, you know, the scope really of how you might be applying your practice to in service of your clients.
Yeah. And in other areas, you know, we might have a Supreme Court case come down or some other major shift in law. I mean, truly, it could happen to any of us. But some practice areas, you're a little more concerned about it. I know my immigration lawyer friends are on social media and are on the alert lists for the major organizations because their work day to day quite literally changes.
Yeah.
So what do you do if you're in one of these practice areas where you're legitimately concerned that something may change? Well, the client comes in, they pay you a $4,000 flat fee to pursue this form of relief. You start preparing it, and then now they're not eligible. Well, you've still spent a lot of time, right? You've invested yourself in this work. But the client's not going to get any value out of it anymore. But neither one of you knew that at the beginning. So you can kind of see the ping pong ball. It's like, well, you should get the fee, but they shouldn't have to pay the fee. But you'll go out of business if you refund everybody's fees. But what value are they getting? You kind of go back and forth. So if you're in one of those practice areas, you know, you should have that in there. Like, if through no fault of my own, the law changes and you're no longer entitled to this relief, we'll split the difference. Or I will pursue a new form of relief, whatever you're eligible for. Whatever it is, you should have some provision so that it's not just like the rug's been pulled out from under both of you. And now what?
So let's kind of wrap this up with a discussion on how do you go about, or do you have some thoughts about what's the best way to upgrade and revise my fee agreement? Just block out an afternoon, pull out the agreement and go through it line by line? Or should you have somebody else review it? Or is there a resource that you would advise that one might take advantage of to improve the agreements? What mechanically, how can I improve this?
Well, I definitely advise setting aside time to focus on it. It's something that deserves your attention, at least an afternoon of real focus. In a lot of states, you'll find a practice guide. In California, CEB puts out a practice guide on fee agreements. And most states will have one where I suggest you flip through it and at least get some ideas, because you may see things in there where you go, oh, I never thought about that. That's a great thing to include. So that's really to add terms, right? Look through there for ideas of things that you haven't covered that maybe you should, to beef it up. On the other hand, you should go through it and take out things that don't matter anymore. You might have terms you just put in there because they were in somebody else's form or the state bar's form, but they have no applicability to what you do. For example, I at one time had lien language in my fee agreement because that was in the original sample I was given, right? That if I get money on your behalf and it's in my trust account and you owe me money, I get to keep what you owe me and give you the rest. Okay. You don't get money when you're defending a bar complaint. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So go through there and take out the terms that are just unnecessary. And so those would really be my initial steps.
Okay.
And then have someone in your practice area run through it with you. And they might have ideas. Be like, oh, I ran into this problem once with a client and now I always use this term in here. And you go, oh, I never thought about that. Great idea. Or they might say, oh, did you know this provision doesn't work? Like, I had a fee arbitration with that provision once, struck down. It's not a good idea. Take it out. So just another head to go through it, but it should be someone who does what you do. Because if you run it by somebody who does some completely different work, they're just in a different set of terms. You don't need the same things they do, and they don't need what you have. So I would definitely recommend sitting down with someone. And then lastly, realize that you're going to continue to revise this thing. It's not one and done. So you should use a template, but have a date on that template in your system, and you know that you're using the latest. Because anytime you run into an issue with a client, you should go back and make sure that there's a way to deal with that in your fee agreement if something like it happens again. Like if you get ghosted by a client, what are you going to do? Oh, it's not in the fee agreement. Let me go add something about that. So it should be kind of a living document, but you should always be using your latest template.
I would add one other thought then. Might be have a non-lawyer read it.
That's a good idea too.
You know,
someone who's like your client.
Yeah, like the client who represents the same kind of interests. And see if they understand it. You know, the more we can do to write it in plain English, you know, maybe even, you know, junior high language, so to speak, you know, the simpler, the better, because it's clear to everybody then what you're talking about and what the issues are.
That's a really great point. And you really should be doing that with your actual clients in mind. You know, if you are, by way of an example of someone I know, you regularly represent non-English speaking farm workers. Right? You might have a simpler version and a translated version to the language most of them speak. It's going to be a requirement anyway.
Right.
So make sure it's really good now and very clear. You know, so your agreement might, maybe you just sacrifice some terms, right? You go, oh my gosh, my clients aren't going to want to read all this mumbo jumbo. I really don't need this part. And so you might have a simpler agreement than if you are representing, you know, major corporations with legal departments reviewing your agreement.
Exactly.
So think about who that client is. And yes, you're right. Make sure that it's clear to whoever it is who's going to be reading it.
Well, Megan, I have an entire page here of notes that apply to my own agreements. So I hope that our listeners did the same thing. If not, go back and re-listen to this episode and pull out your agreement and take a look to see if you've got these T's crossed and I's dotted. And I think we'll all be better off if you do, and because it goes a long way, as we said, to help keep you from having to have that discussion with Megan later if you do have a bar counsel issue to deal with.
That's right. You know, put me out of business.
No, I don't want to do that.
No, don't worry. I'm not concerned. The state bar is far too aggressive for that.
And I feel fairly certain that human nature isn't going to change. So you'll stay plenty busy. Megan, tell our audience, in the event that they do need to get a hold of you, that they do want to follow up with you on anything you had to share with us today, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, on social media, you can find me most active on Twitter, where my handle is at Xavier Law, and my website is xavierlaw.com, where you'll find all of my contact details.
Terrific. And we'll have all of that in the show notes. And I want to thank you again for returning to the scene of the crime, so to speak, and being a three-time repeat here on The Law Entrepreneur. And I can't wait to see you sometime in the future, maybe physically, who knows, when we come out of this current situation that we're in.
Eventually, and there'll be record attendance at whatever that first legal conference in person.
For sure. Megan Xavier, thanks for being a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists, Daylight, and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.